This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, howl at the linguistic moon. In this episode, we're in our feelings, or at least prodding some of the words in the lexicon that are about feelings. It's not an emotionally rousing or demanding episode to listen to, I don't think. No hankies required. However, I will issue the following content note. There are mentions of death, cancer in adults and babies, and suicide. There are also a few Category B swears. On with the show. I was struggling with trying to figure out really what the difference is between sympathy and empathy. Can either of you help me help myself?
Ooh, this is complicated because these are complicated words that have gotten all tangled up in each other, right?
I've had to look up sympathy and empathy so many times today alone to try to fix in my mind what the difference is, because I do find that they're often used as if they're interchangeable, which my descriptivist brain should be fine with, but it clashes with my hankering for semantic clarity. Both words share the path, same as in pathos and pathetic. This was Greek for emotion or suffering. Sympathy has been in English since the late 16th century and etymologically means feeling together. So it's a feeling you share with someone else. Compassion is a Latin translation of the same thing. Meanwhile, the word empathy is a relative newcomer to English from the early 1900s, and it is more about understanding someone's feelings without having to have those feelings yourself. But like feelings themselves, it's difficult to keep these words tidy and defined and not confused.
Sympathy does involve understanding from your own perspective, but empathy involves you doing the work to put yourself in somebody else's shoes.
Like a projection.
Right. For example, we've gone through this hellish year where my baby's had cancer. And so maybe the only people that can have sympathy for me are folks that have gone through something similar, that have had a sick child. But y'all can have empathy for me, right? You can understand that that must feel horrible. And those are both very noble things. It's so funny because, like, empathy's become the emotional connector du jour of our epoch, where, you know, there's radical empathy and everyone talks about empathy and we need to have more empathy. But it seems like empathy has become this thing where it's about you feeling what someone else feels, you trying to walk in someone else's shoes for a mile.
But that's what sympathy is supposed to mean. Although empathy is an English version of the German translation of the Greek empathia, the German version was Einfühlung, and it meant in feeling, so more like entering into someone else's feelings, which I think has more in common with how empathy is often currently used.
So in this weird way, it ends up recentering the self within somebody else's experience.
I also think the reason that we don't use sympathy as much as empathy is because of shame, and people feel that if somebody has sympathy for you, then they pity you. And that means that you should be ashamed of something sometimes. I'm Julia Furlan. I use she, her pronouns. I am an audio professional, which is my latest term for the many things that I do. I edit, I host, I teach.
My name is Sandhya Dirks, and I am a correspondent for NPR on the National Desk. I report on race and identity, but really what I report on is power and systems, and specifically systems of power.
In the audio industry that they and I work in, empathy is venerated as the way to draw in an audience and explain something about the world via a story from a person's lived experience. Not in this show, of course. If I catch an emotion round here, I squash it with my sturdiest dictionary. But Julia and Sandhya have thought deeply about how empathy is deployed in factual storytelling. It can be very bewitching, the notion of changing minds by changing hearts.
I feel like it's actually like a manipulative way to kind of say, look, oh, I've done something. I've cared. I'm a good person. That's enough. I care about this thing that's happening to this poor, poor person.
Well, I suppose it's like a safe context in which to rehearse what your own response might be when something happens to you.
Yeah.
It's like the ultimate choose your own adventure. It's like you're in the thing and you're trying to figure out what you're going to do from there.
We've borrowed somebody's story in order to have an emotional meaning for ourselves, in order to feel like we have compassion for other people. But has anything actually changed? Has our compassion actually grown? Have we reckoned with our own undigested grief? Probably no. And so it creates the sense of having done something when in fact all we've heard is a story.
I'm always really interested in the question of how we communicate complexity. Story as this sort of very highly structured entry point is one way that journalists in particular are taught to communicate complexity. And so we see all the time that like the lead in a news article has to start with a human interest, that what we're trying to talk about is all of the factors that have led to significant delays in airports. And that's actually about the pandemic and hiring practices and shifting labor laws and the financial state of the airline industry. But the opening paragraph has to be about an 18-year-old who's been stranded in the airport for 36 hours and had to sleep on a yoga mat. Because we need an entry point into complexity. It's too much. It's too big. We can't just look at a system and be like, oh, yeah, look at the system. This is bad. We want to know, how is it impacting people? And that is, for a lot of people, a useful entry point. But I think we overuse it and as a result lose sight of things that actually can't be explained well via anecdote or via personal individual experience. My name is Hannah McGregor. I am an academic and a writer and a podcaster living on the traditional and unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations. And I am the author of A Sentimental Education, out now with Wilfrid Laurier University Press. My book is about the conundrum that I think many people who love literature and storytelling encounter at some point in our lives, which is that books have been incredibly meaningful to us. Stories have shaped who we are. And yet any claims that reading or listening to a particular kind of podcast or watching a particular kind of movie make you a better or more empathetic person, those claims really fall apart the second you apply any pressure to them. So what do we do with the kind of irreconcilability of, I believe that stories have meant a huge amount to me and have shaped the person I have become, and yet highly literate cultures are not kinder?
Well, I mean, now you put it like that, that does seem like a flaw.
It does, doesn't it?
Or maybe they'd be worse than they are.
Maybe they'd be worse. You're right. We haven't been A/B testing. But I certainly think built into this sense of reading makes you better is, of course, a deeply classed argument that is based on the sort of tradition of who can seek out a liberal arts education, who has the leisure time to engage in reading for pleasure, these kinds of questions. So there's, I think, often a lot at stake in the idea that I, a person who spends time reading, am just a more empathetic and kinder person. And again, you know, look at people who are middle class and highly educated, and then look at folks who maybe have not had access to education, to formal education, or who don't read. And are they crueler people? Are they less empathetic people? Again, I don't think any argument that suggests that would actually hold water.
I don't know where I achieved empathy from. I do think I have it now. Mm-hmm. But the stories that were prevalent when I was a child were not nice ones. They weren't kind. They were like fairy stories where a witch would make you vomit diamonds at best, but a wolf might eat you. Or it's like Roald Dahl, where you feed some poison to your grandmother.
Yeah.
Ha,
yep.
Ha, ha.
So those are stories with their own lessons. It's just that in that particular tradition of the fairy tale, the lesson is a cautionary one. That it's the establishment of taboo and the creation of a set of acceptable behaviors. And that's one tradition of children's literature. And then there's another tradition of children's literature, which is about watching children learn to be kind and be rewarded for being kind. And that's the tradition that I certainly grew up reading. am I kind because I read all of these books where, like, plucky girls were kind and were ultimately rewarded for it?
Well, there's no control experiment.
No way of knowing.
So, inconclusive. What do you think about the recent trend for be kind just being a slogan?
So this, when I asked the question, like, am I kind because these books made me kind, part of what's loaded into that question is kindness at all useful, particularly as a politic? And any evocations of kindness as a universal good, any requests that we all put our differences aside and find our common humanity immediately makes me suspicious. Like, that's the moment when the sentimentality radar starts pinging.
It can be a bit of a thought stopper, can't it?
It is a thought stopper. It is absolutely a thought stopper. Be kind suggests, it has a kind of implicit second clause after it. Be kind instead of, right? Be kind, don't be critical. Be kind, don't think too much about what's going on here. And it's that implicit second clause that kindness needs to supplant critical attention to the conditions of our world.
Or complex thought.
Yes.
I approve of kindness when appropriately applied, for sure, but I preferred it when it was subtext, not text.
And when it becomes an imperative.
Yeah.
The moment it becomes an imperative, it becomes a way to then label those who are kind and those who are not.
And how do you quantify kindness? Is there a test to prove it? How do you even know what kindness is? It might vary in any given situation. Also, it's a bit of a buzzword at the moment, but things could change semantically for kindness at any time. Sentimental was, similarly, a catchword in the 18th century, when in many European cultures there was a trend towards work about emotions in philosophy and the arts, theatre, novels, music, paintings, sentimentality, all over the place. But with every trend, there's a backlash, and sentimentality was discredited as self-indulgence and too much feeling precluded enough thinking. Thus, by the end of the 18th century, sentimental had become a diss, and more than 200 years later, it still hasn't really escaped that. How would you define sentimentality?
Oh, I mean, with great difficulty. It's an incredibly slippery word. But in general, it is kind of a mode of storytelling or a form of culture that is extremely interested in the emotional landscape and that is particularly interested in the way that we can use emotion to overcome difference. Sentimentality was also a genre of writing starting in the 19th century, maybe starting earlier, but certainly sort of coming to the forefront in the 19th century with books like Uncle Tom's Cabin that have very particular genre logics that, like, a sentimental novel does the following things in the same way we can expect, like, a sci-fi novel to do the following things. The genre of the sentimental novel sort of emerged out of the same historical moment as the sort of cult of domesticity.
The sentimental literature I just mentioned before that flourished as part of the Enlightenment movement in 18th century Europe was mostly written by men and about big feelings. But in 19th century USA, sentimental writing was associated with women and the emotions were packed up neat and tidy and definitely not epic.
It's predominantly women's writing, not exclusively, but largely women writing sentimental novels. And they tend to be novels that are about women learning to be the way that they ought to be. So women learning emotional self-management, domestic management, and white women, explicitly white women, learning how to become the kind of angel in the house that was the paragon of white femininity. And that very frequently took the form of these stories about girls encountering emotional challenges and learning to deal with them so that ultimately they can mature into the kind of women that we need in order to reproduce the white nation state is the sort of goal, like the reproduction of the of whiteness via becoming a mother and wife.
What's the reason for that trend flourishing in the 19th century? Was it increased literacy amongst white women?
Very much so, yeah. Increased literacy, increased access to authorship, increased access to education, as well as like a particular kind of logic of empire at work, because the 19th century is kind of the peak of British imperialism. Sentimentality is also a sort of technology of imperialism that says, like, look at how white women make the world better. Look at how white women can provide the stable domestic space that men can return to, that sort of helps the empire to establish continuity despite chaos that is the actual reality of imperial expansion. It's violence, it's chaos, it's war. But at its heart, we have the angel in the house making everything continue smoothly and beautifully. Sentimentality can also be a relationship we have to a piece of culture that itself is not inherently sentimental. So I have a sentimental attachment to, say, that movie or that book or that place because of the way that I have imprinted an emotional narrative onto it. Part of my interest in sentimentality was realizing the role that it played in my own process of responding to my mother's illness and then death. So my mother was diagnosed with cancer when I was 8 and then died by suicide when I was 16 after a terminal diagnosis. And through that period, I really sort of attached myself to these stories because they made her death make sense, because that was a thing that women did. And in the process, you know, it gave me a script. It gave me a sort of way of managing what felt completely out of control. And also, it stripped away her complexity as a person. Because once you have turned a person into a sentimental trope, they're not a person anymore. They're not complex and messy and somebody who I had screaming fights with and disagreed with about stuff. Now they're just an idea about what a mother becomes. And it took me a really long time to realize that my application of these sort of sentimental tropes to this personal experience was stripping away so much of the nuance and the complexity in it, and stripping away so much of the person that she was. But the thing is that when you strip away that very helpful framing that makes everything make sense, you then have to stare deep into the howling storm of meaninglessness. That you just have to say, oh, people die because no reason. There's no reason. That's because we're meat, because we're made out of meat. And sometimes our meat goes bad and then we die.
Well, that's the reason. Meat decay.
That's the reason. That's it. And that is a lot harder, I think, to wrap your head around than these sort of lovely, tidy, tied up with a bow, you know, she died because she was too pure for this world.
Or she had a kind of picturesque but unnamed wasting disease with no obvious symptoms until she breathed her last.
Yes, yes, precisely.
So there's a lot of literature centered around children with dead mothers.
It's very useful to have a dead mother.
Do you notice much sentimental stuff people say to you regarding your mother's illness and death then or now?
Absolutely. The hardest thing, I think, is encountering the way other people want to sanctify her. That people want your dead mother to be a saint, because that's what a dead mother is for. And that is a thing that people have wanted to apply to me in some way, a sort of, well, you got to become the person you are because she died, and isn't that beautiful?
Ooh. Oh, that's a variation on Everything Happens for a Reason.
It is absolutely a variation on Everything Happens for a Reason. You know, it helped you become the person you were sooner because you went through, you know, you learn. Like, people really want to reframe it. And I just, like, what a...
Without suffering, you would have been an insubstantial person, of course.
Absolutely. Can you imagine me without a major childhood tragedy?
What if we would have been better without some of the things happening?
What if some of the things were genuinely just bad? What if I'm becoming worse?
Yeah.
But also just what a way of stripping her of her own humanity, of being like, you were just a trope in somebody else's life journey.
An inciting incident.
You are just an inciting incident. But we love doing that to people, right? We love taking people and turning them into side characters in our lives who, like, have something to teach us and then helpfully exit before they gain any complexity.
What it makes me think of is that, like, stories are keyholes. You think that you're getting the full picture, but your eye is up against the keyhole and you're really just seeing whatever that's given to you. And I think that that part of it is the biggest problem that journalists and quote unquote storytellers, whatever you call yourself, audio professionals, what I use so that I don't have to say any of the other things, but like, I think that there's so much manipulation that listeners or readers do not get because they're not getting the full context. And when you pick up a microphone in our profession and you point it at someone, there is no way that you can get the full context of someone's humanity. And if you're having empathy for somebody without the full context of their humanity, I don't know how that works exactly.
It's not just a keyhole. When we talk about empathy, like, it's also the idea that you can get outside of yourself, that we can imagine someone else's experience, is like so audacious because human beings are not that freaking imaginative. I mean, like, a unicorn is just a horse with a horn. We did not go that far to get to our most magical creature. We just, like, grafted two things on top of each other. So the idea that you can actually fully imagine yourself as someone else, and this becomes most problematic when we are asked to imagine somebody who is sitting in the crosshairs of systems that are completely different from us, or systems that work for some folks if you are white, if you are male, if you are of a certain class. Those systems were built to work for you. They were built to work against other folks. And you can't sort of empathize your way through understanding how those systems are operating on people. And so I think that that's where empathy as a narrative strategy really becomes manipulation, because it's this idea that you can feel someone else's pain, and their pain then is their only thing. That's who they are. That's what they are reduced to, rather than not only a complex, fully lived human life, but also to understand that what is happening to them isn't just an emotional process. It's also a systemic one.
Yeah, that's the thing about story as well, just often the reduction of people to trauma and to their lived experience and not their thoughts and ideas.
Yeah, because otherwise, I mean, struggle is really boring, you know, like actually living a struggle experience, living a traumatic experience, living the repercussions of that traumatic experience. And especially if it is over a lifetime, that is not an exciting experience. It is hard. I mean, I guess it's not always boring, but it's not great. And when you put someone on the worst day of their life or in the worst period of their life in the middle of your story so that it can take a turn and up the emotional stakes, you're doing that on their back. You're doing that by putting them in that position. And it's not fair.
You're also doing it to center the audience, right?
Exactly.
And that's so that the audience can empathize. And, you know, if you're making things for a certain audience and the audience is somebody like you, then you're skewing that person's story to center the viewer rather than the liver of the life. And empathy is a way to hit us emotionally. And when you're talking about hitting someone emotionally, you're talking about manipulating them. I love this idea. I'm even tempted by it, this idea of purely connecting through emotion, but it's impossible.
It's also, we have to separate between empathy as it works and empathy as this beautiful idea. Because I do think actually empathy is a beautiful idea. We want to feel connected to each other, right? And so I think empathy is this incredibly noble concept. And I think we have to remember that before we start to tear it down.
I also think that in practice, it does a lot of absolving us, right? And a lot of hiding its actual more nefarious operational status, which is to often reify and reinforce power dynamics. And that it's absolutely a manipulative technique.
Hannah McGregor, at the time you and I are talking, I'm in England and the Queen died a few days ago. Mm-hmm. And it is a very sentimental time. Mm. And the impact of the sentimentality, of course, is to shut down any critique of the institution of monarchy.
Yeah.
Let alone any examination of what the Queen personally may have done.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And so in that moment, we can see how sentimentality is being used as a call to find a common ground that explicitly denies the possibility of engaging with politics or history in any real way. That the suggestion is that we must unite around this shared feeling of mourning, and that within that shared feeling of mourning, we can't actually say anything specific, because to be specific would disrupt the sentimental urge, which is why sentimentality is often so depoliticizing.
Well, it's a very effective form of propaganda, because it does really stop people doing anything.
Yep. Yep, absolutely.
Rather than rousing them to action, it's sort of the opposite thing. It's like a kind of sleepy gas pumped into our brains.
It is a sleepy gas pumped into our brains. And a lot of critics of sentimentality have essentially argued that very same thing, that sentimental novels and sentimental culture in general is meant to make us feel good and feel like we are doing something while actually causing no change of any variety.
And this is the other reason that story gets privileged so heavily. It's because we don't want to bore people by talking about systems. We just want to talk about people's feelings and emotions. But when you do that, you keep things in the level of the psychological. And when you do that, you're actually limiting what the story is telling, because it's just telling a story that's sort of based in this kind of arbitrary idea that we are only bound by our emotional selves, which is not how the world works. People get how power operates if you just take them there. If you share with them some of the ways in which these systems are functioning around these emotional experiences, people will follow you because they get it, because they recognize it. But otherwise, you're basically denying the way in which systems work, right? You're creating an invisible force field. You're not naming it. It's connection without analysis.
Right.
It's connection without understanding. And it doesn't mean we should stop telling stories, because you know what? I love stories. And I love fictional stories, and I love non-fictional stories, and I think they're so powerful. They really are. The reason I talk about this and I shit on empathy and I shit on stories is because I love the idea of those things. I just think we have this illusion that they exist in a way that they don't. And I would like us to try to use them in the best way possible. So stories are all bullshit, but also they're magical, and we should do a better job of understanding what they're capable of and the ways in which they manipulate us and others.
I like to think that people can achieve empathy without seeing an identifiable story before they're willing to make that leap. Mm. But perhaps I'm being naive, optimistic.
I think that these kinds of identifiable stories are one of many possible building blocks in creating your own sort of empathetic relation to the world.
Granted, thinking about, say, stories in the Bible where they pop it into a parable, so kind of slips into the brain a bit easier than if you were generous to your fellow men and shared your stuff, that would be a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the allegorical instinct is there throughout Western literature, and I also think is so much messier than we tend to actually see, because often we sort of pull these allegories out and then just hold on to the allegory without returning to the original story. So we've got all of these biblical allegories where we're like, yeah, 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 a thing happens. Anyway, the allegory is turn the other cheek.
I'll figure out how to multiply my fish.
Yeah, like go back and read the actual story and you're like, sorry, how did we get to turn the other cheek? The stories are messy and wild and weird. And then we pull out the allegory and say, we can stop paying attention to the details. Here's what it actually means. And there is, you know, it's a similar compulsion to be like, oh, here's the messy, incomprehensible stuff of reality. Let's just pull out the allegory. Let's just find the kernel. But in the process of deciding what constitutes the kernel, we are always applying a particular lens.
Mm.
You got to decide what the moral of a story is. And that moral is not inherent. It's not natural. It's not spontaneous.
Well, I was just thinking the kernel's in the living room with the lead pipe.
Yeah.
I suppose those are the preconceptions I've come with.
See, I'm just thinking about popcorn. So, you know, we're different. We contain multitudes.
I'm always thinking a bit about popcorn.
Also, homonyms.
I feel like I've made you be quite critical of sentimentality while we've been talking. But there is also usefulness to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, at the very least, there's an emotional vent for people, or they're able to access an emotion within themselves that perhaps they had been unable to access or deliberately avoiding.
There is a place for emotional reactions to things. There is a place for feeling in our politics. And attending to emotion is not automatically or inherently depoliticizing. In fact, sometimes taking our emotions seriously can be a really important political intervention. It doesn't have to be a sort of opiate of the masses. There needs to be room for emotion within these critiques that we are engaged in. Refusing to let those things be divided off, refusing to say, over here on the one hand are people having an emotional reaction to the Queen's death, and over here on the other hand are those of us who are too smart to fall for that, and we are better than them because they're doing feelings, and we're doing brains, and brains are better than feelings, is a trap for everybody involved, because it turns those of us who are critical of, like, the monarchy and British imperialism into people who hate feelings and love when old ladies die.
I mean, that's just coincidence.
But it also means it's its own form of stripping out complexity, right? Because, okay, I have absolutely no interest in the monarchy as a system. And the death of the Queen made me miss my lovely British Nana, who loved the Queen so much. And I loved that woman. And the Queen connects me to her in a way that did cause me to have an emotional reaction to the Queen's death. And I don't have to pretend that I don't have an emotional connection to this sort of whole complex series of events in order to also not like the monarchy. And an insistence that I can't have a sentimental reaction to the Queen and still be critical of the monarchy is an insistence that sort of traps us all in an either-or version of the world. And the reality is we can have sentimental reactions to things. Often those sentimental reactions connect us to our own histories, to our loved ones, to stories that have been meaningful to us. And you don't have to slice that part of yourself off in order to also be somebody who, like, thinks about history.
Yeah. Well, also, she was one human being as well as figurehead of an institution, and you can have differing feelings about those things.
Yes. Yeah, you can.
I mean, I don't have to, but...
No, you don't have to. But one might.
So we're not, to make it clear to people, we're not saying don't be unempathetic in the sense that don't care at all about your fellow human beings.
Not at all. Yeah.
Care so much. Care more. But don't care at the limits of yourself. Understanding without analysis isn't really understanding, right? So like, it's also the limits of empathy.
Don't have no empathy, but don't stop at empathy. Empathy is just the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that.
It's not the beginning and end of the work.
Empathy is just the empathy is a doorway. It's a way in, but you still have a whole world to explore. If you feel empathy for somebody, that's just a starting point.
You heard from, in order of appearance and also reverse order of appearance, Sandhya Dirks, Julia Falan, and Hannah McGregor. I'll link to them all at theillusionist.org/sentiment. Sandhya Dirks and Julia Falan are audio makers, and Hannah McGregor is an academic and a podcaster. Her shows include Witch Please and The Secret Feminist Agenda. And her new book about emotion and sentimentality in storytelling is A Sentimental Education, out now. The Illusionist is an independent podcast, and if you have any spare cash lying around and would like to prop up purveyors of podcasts, send yourself towards theillusionist.org/donate, and in return you receive extra written content, including my latest etymology discoveries, and you get to hang out in the Illusiverse Discord with your fellow etymology enthusiasts who also share life advice and support and recommendations for things to read, watch, listen to, and cook. And recently, they've also shared their favourite spoons, because it's the small things that get us through this life, the small but exquisite spoons. Join us at theillusionist.org/donate. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is immanent. That's immanent with an A, not an I, like how I used to have to introduce the allusionist. Immanent, adjective, existing or operating within. Brackets of God, close brackets, permanently pervading the universe. Often contrasted with transcendent. Try using immanent in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Saltzman. Thanks to Martin Austwick for editorial assistance and The Illusionist Music. Hear his compositions via palebirdmusic.com and as Palebird on Bandcamp and Spotify. Our ad partner is Multitude. To sponsor an episode of the show, contact them at multitude.productions/ads. Find me at Illusionist Show on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and find every episode of the podcast in audio and transcript form, and the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words, and links to the guests, plus more information about the episode topics, all at the show's forever home, theillusionist.org.